Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Cochran, Judge Johnson, Judge Reyes, the Honorable Jean M. Cochran presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is March 3rd, 2022, for the benefit of the recording. We have five cases on our calendar today, three oral cases and two non-oral cases. We are hearing the oral cases on the Zoom platform today, as you're well aware. The same procedural rules apply to our Zoom oral arguments. Each party will have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. As you know, we are recording this oral argument. Any other recordings of the oral argument are not permitted except with the express prior permission of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. And with that, I will call the first case, which is A21-1576 in the matter of the civil commitment of Walter Johann Happel. I hope I pronounced his name. Correct me if I didn't, counsel, please let me know. I'll ask that the attorneys please introduce themselves and the party they represent at the beginning of their argument, and counsel for appellant can proceed when you're ready.
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning. Attorney Jessica Buberl, B-U-B-E-R-L, on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Walter Happel. He is also present, I believe, by remote Zoom video, observing these proceedings as well. May it please the court, counsel. As the court is aware, we're here today to discuss the following questions. One, was clear and convincing evidence presented that allowed the trial court to conclude that appellant is a sexually dangerous person, or SDP? Two, was clear and convincing evidence presented that allowed the trial court to conclude that appellant is a sexual psychopathic personality, or SPP? In a brief overview of the facts in this case are that following a three-day contested trial in Washington County District Court in July 2021, my client, Mr. Happel, was indeterminately civilly committed as both SDP and SPP. This trial was a result of a petition for civil commitment filed by the Washington County Attorney's Office in February 2021, and this petition was filed prior to my client's release from prison. In 2015, my client pled guilty to and was convicted of criminal sexual conduct in the first degree, interfamilial sexual abuse in the second and fourth degrees, and surreptitious interference with privacy. This last conviction, to be clear, was the result of an Alford plea. My client obviously pled guilty, not admitting the crimes, but acknowledging that the evidence would have been sufficient to convict him. So for that last conviction, it was a result of an Alford plea. This was found by the trial court to be a conviction for interference with privacy against a minor under 18 in finding of fact number 20. But just to point out, and this is important to my client, it was not that type of conviction. It was for surreptitious interference with privacy. So it was not for any type of criminal sexual conduct. Based upon these convictions, he is subject to supervised release by the Minnesota Department of Corrections until May 17th, 2024. So the state of Minnesota does have significant oversight of him until 2024, and he will be required to register as a level 3 sex offender. Prior to the
counsel, I think you can assume that the judges on this panel are familiar with the facts. I know we've all read the briefs and the district court's decision and are familiar with the record. So with that, I have a question for you relating to the district court's factual findings. Based on your brief, it doesn't appear that appellant is challenging any of the district court's factual findings. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. My client overall significantly disputes the evidence that was presented at trial. He vigorously opposed it. He adamantly testified against it. And so credibility was important at trial. The trial court unfortunately did find that my client was not credible. And so, yes, this court is correct that I am not specifically challenging any specific finding of fact. However, my client is vigorously opposing the court's conclusions of law based upon those findings of fact and saying this evidence was not clear and convincing. Based upon the court's findings of fact, but he is adamantly opposed to all of those findings of fact, and the court can see that from his testimony and from a review of the transcript at trial.
Ms. Booberl, are the district court's conclusions supported by the risk assessment tools, the evidence of those risk assessment tools as interpreted by the expert witnesses?
Are the conclusions of law supported? Well, my client's argument is no. The district court's conclusions of law are not supported. The actuarial assessments are not clear and convincing to support the district court's conclusions of law that my client qualifies as both SDP and SPP. So I submit no. No, my client does not agree with that.
And can you be more specific or more particular about how that evidence falls short of the standard required?
Well, yes, Your Honor. For example, one thing is that, and I understand that two examiners at trial did testify that they would have scored him differently on, for example, the actuarial assessment. And I have to get the exact name of it, the static 99R. My client on that actuarial assessment scored average risk. However, both examiners at trial testified that that's artificially low. However, if we're going to use actuarial assessments and rely on actuarial assessments, then I submit that that evidence was not clear and convincing. That score on that particular actuarial assessment was not clear and convincing evidence to support the district court's conclusions that my client is likely to offend again or highly likely to engage in acts of harmful sexual conduct in the future. So what I'm submitting, Your Honor, is also to as far as the prong in Minnesota Statute 253D.02 subdivision 16, the evidence was not clear and convincing that my client engaged in a course of harmful sexual conduct. So what I'm asking this court to do is to look at that evidence and see if that evidence was clear and convincing that there was an actual course of harmful sexual conduct, because I submit there was not. The allegations are varied. The criminal convictions were varied. It seems that there early on there were criminal convictions for or early behaviors and criminal convictions for criminal sexual conduct. But then later on, there were allegations of this surreptitious interference. Let me get the language correct. Surreptitious interference with privacy. I submit that the allegations under supporting that Alford plea are radically different from the allegations and the convictions and the behavior supporting those convictions. I submit that those don't constitute a course of harmful sexual conduct under that statute, Minnesota Statute 253D, Subdivision 16, paren 1, because they are so varied and different. I would refer the court to a case cited in my brief, the Civil Commitment of Stone, page 837, where the court points out that this statute does not define course or specify the number of incidents necessary to qualify as a course. However, case law indicates that course is a systematic or orderly succession or a sequence. The course of harmful sexual conduct, it's inherent that there be a requirement that the sexual conduct be similar to constitute a course. So the point I'm trying to make is that the sexual conduct is not similar enough to constitute a course. And therefore, the evidence was not clear and convincing on that specific prong of the statute.
But counsel, on that point, even if we disregard that conduct, isn't there enough sufficient conduct prior to that to satisfy the course of harmful sexual conduct requirement?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit there isn't. Appellant was convicted in 2015. He testified during the 2015 plea hearing to some misconduct occurring between 1986 and 1988, as well as 1984. And subsequent to those time periods, and Your Honor, I need to review the record to ensure, but subsequent to those time periods, I submit that evidence, those what he testified to during his 2015 plea hearing, no, is not sufficient to, and what he acknowledged in his 2015 plea hearing is not sufficient to support overall the court finding clear and convincing evidence. I'm not sure if that answers the court's question or not.
But the record isn't limited to just what he agreed to at the plea hearing, you know, the record before the district court in the civil commitment case, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. The court can consider, case law is clear that this court can consider both charged and uncharged conduct and allegations for which there was no conviction. That is correct, Your Honor. And I acknowledge that. However, this evidence still not does, even though if there's not a conviction, even if it's not charged, the trial court still needs to find that evidence, along with any convictions, are clear and convincing. It requires obviously more than a preponderance, less than proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But the reason that we're on appeal here is my client, I believe, is 70 years old, perhaps today. He has very strong liberty interests. He does not want to obviously be indeterminately committed for potentially the rest of his life to the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. He has an interest, a liberty interest in where he resides, whether it's in a locked facility, what city he resides in, what treatment he receives. His life is at stake in this proceeding. And so while I do acknowledge that fact and other facts in this case, I think it is imperative just based upon the serious nature of these proceedings. And I appreciate this court viewing this case through the higher burden of proof lens and closely scrutinizing the evidence presented. I submit that after the court does so, after reviewing the voluminous records that were introduced as exhibits in this case, which my client, again, disputed at trial, many of the allegations in this case, I submit that this court, after its review, and after its review of the case law cited in my brief, as well as opposing counsel's brief, I ask that this court conclude that the trial court erred in finding that my client is both SDP and SPP, as the evidence is not clear and convincing. I request that the matter be reversed and the petition for civil commitment be dismissed. I would yield the remainder. I believe I might have a couple minutes, but I would yield the remainder of my time or reserve it for rebuttal. I do appreciate the court's time in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Burble. Counsel for respondent, you can proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is James Zuliger. That's spelled Z as in zebra, U-L-E-G-E-R. I'm an assistant Washington County attorney, and I represent respondent in this appeal. I also represented the respondent in the trial court matter, so I am familiar with both the pretrial, the trial, and the appellate proceedings of this matter today. What I'd like to just point out with the court, and it's already in our brief, that this appears to be a sufficiency of the evidence appeal. Does the record adequately support the trial court's determination, the general determination being that does Mr. Happel meet criteria for commitment as a sexually dangerous person and or as a person with a sexual psychopathic personality? I would note that this was a 3-day trial. There were thousands of pages that were admitted as exhibits into the record, including audio recordings and transcripts. The court made at least 100 findings of fact, but I think if you actually look at the court's order, given the amount of detail, the subparts, the narrative, you could argue that it was almost 200 findings of fact in this matter. This court looked at every piece of evidence and weighted appropriately. And at the end of the day, we're not actually here challenging the court's findings. Deference is given to the court for findings of fact, and it appears that there's not any specific challenge to the facts as found by the court. The court's review is a de novo review as to whether those facts adequately support the ultimate determination or conclusion. Does Mr. Happel meet criteria for commitment as STP, SPP? And we believe clear and convincing evidence adequately does support that finding. Now, the appeal, specifically what was briefed, does provide or assert a general challenge that clear and convincing evidence doesn't support that Mr. Happel meets criteria, but the brief seemed to be focused on, does he meet the high likelihood criteria of future sexual recidivism? Before going to that, counsel did raise another challenge that wasn't brief that I just want to briefly respond to, that the evidence doesn't support that there was a course of sexual misconduct. And I think it's worth noting, and this was actually argued quite a bit in the lower court's briefs or arguments to that court, that with respect to the SDP criteria, there simply needs to be a course of sexual misconduct. It doesn't need to be, quote, habitual. And the significance of that, and actually I think it's referenced in Stone, the case counsel cited, that you know, the courts need not be focused whether there's similarity, if you will. So that's just not relevant. And a course of misconduct is, very simply put, more than one. With respect to the SPP criterion, there has to be the habitual course of misconduct. And the court did find that there was sufficient similarity, and it was supported by the testimony of both the court examiners and also additional examiners' report that were submitted into the evidence. It's unchallenged that, you know, over the course of multiple decades, Mr. Happel victimized at least 14 identifiable minors, six of which have been actual criminal sexual assaults. The remainder were numerous school-age children at the school that Mr. Happel worked, where he was, peeping on them, if you will, while they were using the bathrooms. The nature of these assaults were extensive and pervasive, and it wasn't much of a challenge for this court to find that there was sufficient similarity of the course of Mr. Happel's sexual misconduct to determine that he met criteria for SPP as well.
Getting back, is the invasion of privacy properly considered in the determination?
Your Honor, I don't believe that the district court, and we didn't necessarily specifically argue that that conviction or those incidents, if you were actually part of the course of sexual misconduct, meaning, you know, that they met that element. We certainly believe that the assaults against his two biological sons and two additional neighbor boys and two nieces, more than sufficiently shows that he met that criteria. However, I don't think we should discount that behavior either, because I think it's evidence that, you know, of his sexual deviancy, his diagnosis is pedophilia. And in addition to that, that it appears to be very strong and entrenched. And it was an issue that was raised by Mr. Happel's attorney at trial, that there was a 20-year break and shouldn't, at least in reported offenses from the mid-90s to 2002, and should he not be credited, or shouldn't that be taken into consideration when we determine if he is high likelihood? And I think why that's relevant, the interference of privacy, is to show that he still has that deviancy. it's not going away. And the fact that there may not have been reported cases during that span simply means there hasn't been reported cases doesn't necessarily mean that there wasn't misconduct. Now, I'm not certainly asking this court to presume that there was, but it's not necessarily exculpatory, knowing what we know about sex offenses against children, being that they're underreported, that, you know, we do normally have a break in reported cases because these cases just don't get reported very often, unfortunately.
Just kind of following up on that, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed that the two doctors considered the behavior, when he was working as a custodian.
Well, they certainly did. It was significant in their analysis, and perhaps the examiners, as part of their support, also considered that behavior as far as meeting that prong of whether he's engaged in a course of misconduct or a habitual course of misconduct. But at the end of the day, it's a bit of a moot point, because even if we don't say that those incidents actually meet that particular element, he still meets that element by the other sexual misconduct. Getting to the specific challenge by appellant, whether the record adequately supports the district court's finding that Mr. Happel is a high likelihood of recidivizing. I think the record as a whole clearly supports that he is. And I think it's appropriate to emphasize that this court and this Minnesota Supreme Court have emphasized and reasserted over the years that this is a multi-factor test. And we're really supposed to engage in what we call the, quote, Linehan factors. And the court clearly did that in this case. Linehan is cited in both parties' respective briefs. And the specific considerations or the challenge that appellant makes as to the support, their support that he doesn't meet that high likelihood prong is that he's going to be set. I think he turned 70 today. He plans to go home, be retired, and live with his spouse, and that should be sufficient mitigation to warrant a conclusion that he's less than high likelihood. This court and the examiners who testified addressed those specific considerations when the court did its Linehan analysis. Now, the examiners testified at length, and this is in relation to the actuarials that were used, that as a sex offender age, generally speaking, the typical sex offender, the studies show that the risk of recidivism generally decrease. However, that's more applicable, as testified to by both Dr. Lovett and Dr. Alsdorf, to what they coin as an example, a power rapist, somebody who uses, physical force, if you will, to commit sexual crimes to another. The general understanding that recidivism is reduced as an offender age does not apply to offenders who abuse children. Dr. Lovett and Dr. Alsdorf both testified that, based on their own personal experience, that offending with respect to that offender continues on into the offender's 60s, 70s, and 80s, and age does not seem to have an effect on those offenders. And that is the type of offender that Mr. Happel falls into here. His victims are mostly prepubescent children. There was only one report of actual physical force, but others were more the grooming type of behavior. He still displayed disturbing behaviors, namely the interference of privacy on the school children at his school by peeping at him in the bathroom well into his 60s to show that this deviancy is strong. It's not going away. And also based on the examiner's testimony that in addition to that, Mr. Happel has one heck of a personality disorder, which coupled with that, in their opinions, is simply, you know, age does not mitigate Mr. Happel's risk. And I think I'll just segue from that into the actuarial argument that, you know, the specific actuarial, there was one other, but the main one that was discussed at the lower court level is the static 99. It's the 10 static factors that examiners in these cases pretty much use in every case. It is a very useful tool, but the emphasis should be that it's just a tool. It's just one of many things we need to look at. And the examiners did score him, and according to the score, he is given a +2, which falls into a general category that he's of average risk. Now, mind you, that's average when compared to other sex offenders, not necessarily the general population. However, if you were not to give Mr. Happel credit for his age, they take off 3 points for somebody of Mr. Happel's age, he would be a +5, which would put him at an above average risk. So I think it's useful to say that the actuarial, while we should employ them, we should look at them, but it's just still part of the overall factors we are to look at. And the Supreme Court in INSEE not too long ago said, don't worry too much about the actuarials. They are relevant. The court can consider them and the court can give the actuarial the appropriate weight, but it should be used as part of everything else to look at. And everything else to look at are mainly the Linehan factors. And in addition to this are the dynamic factors, which both Dr. Lovett and Dr. Alsdorf focused on in their analysis extensively, you know, before the lower court, that based on their analysis showed that he was at very high likelihood of risk of recidivism. And I guess I would point out, and it's reasserted in our brief before this court, and I believe the district court also noted it in her findings, Dr. Lovett's 4 critically important dynamic factors, I think they speak volumes as to why Mr. Happel is a high likelihood of risk. Very briefly, he demonstrates that, first off, he has a very strong sexual deviancy, pedophilia. But secondly, what's very problematic is the lack of completion of sex offender treatment. Not only has Mr. Happel not participated in sex offender treatment, he is assertively refused, even when mandated to by the Department of Corrections, even under penalty of 6 additional months of prison. So based on his testimony, he considered the sex offender treatment garbage, and he, in his mind, thought it was better simply to take 6 more months than to participate in that treatment. That's extraordinarily concerning to both the examiners and to the lower court. Additionally, there is general criminality and lifestyle instability for Mr. Happel. The record shows he's impulsive, self-focused, deceptive, manipulative, and utterly has no remorse or empathy for his victims. And that segues into his attitudes. Mr. Happel is a categorical denier, and he even denies the offenses he pled to and even that he admitted to, even under a recording. I see my time is up. Unless your honors have any questions, I'll briefly wrap up, if that's okay.
Yes, just briefly. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, we believe the record speaks for itself. The findings are not challenged on appeal by the district court. The district court's findings more than sufficiently demonstrates by clear and convincing evidence that Mr. Happel meets criteria for commitment as SDP and SPP. We respectfully ask this court to affirm the lower court's decision. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Just briefly, yes, Your Honor. Thank you. As far as the sex offender treatment, it was important to note for my client that he was not sentenced to complete sex offender treatment. There was no requirement that he complete it. He was willing to complete it, and he said he would go to Lionel Lakes for the treatment. And he did receive an additional 6 months of extended incarceration, but he was not, there was no requirement in any type of sentence that he complete any type of sex offender treatment. As far as whether the issue of whether my client engaged in a course of harmful sexual conduct under Minnesota Statute 253D.02 subdivision 16, this was briefed, a general challenge. I argued in my brief that my client on page 7 does not meet, the evidence was not clear and convincing that he meets every prong of the SDP statute. And so I submit that this was actually briefed and that he did not engage in a course of harmful sexual conduct. As far as under the
also, to that point, did you make the specific argument that you're making on here today, though?
That
relating to the Alford plea, and that shouldn't be
the similarity.
Yes.
Specifically in my brief, no. As to that specific argument, no, I did not include that in my brief. But I submit that that's encompassed within the argument as to whether the evidence was clear and convincing. In a review of the evidence, I'm arguing today that a review of that evidence shows that the evidence was not similar enough to constitute a course of harmful sexual conduct. And also then the same with the statutory requirements in Minnesota Statute 253D.02 subdivision 15 as to whether my client meets by the statutory definition of an SVP by clear and convincing evidence. I submit that was briefed in my brief on page 9, in that the evidence was not clear and convincing that he meets the statutory definition when considering all of the required factors under Minnesota case law. Specifically, those factors, for example, in Linehan, cited in my brief, Blodgett, Bieganowski, B-I-E-G-A-N-O-W-S-K-I. These cases are, I believe, all from 1994. And when this court compares the facts in those cases to the facts alleged in this case, as well as the convictions in this case, I submit that the conduct is quite different when comparing those cases and the factors therein to my client and the conduct alleged herein, and when and analyzing those factors for my client. And so again, I simply ask that this court find that the district court erred when it concluded there was clear and convincing evidence to find that my client meets the statutory definition for both SDP and SVP. And I do thank this court for its time. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments today.